So our topic this morning is accompaniment in the modern magisterium. And let's begin at the end of the story, and then we'll work our way back to the beginning. In the latter chapters of Amoris Laetitia, after having provided a thorough and at times lyrical description of marriage, Pope Francis turns his attention to the challenges to marriage faced by individuals and couples today. He addresses with a pastor's heart those individuals in de facto unions, which, including cohabitation, function as a type of substitute for marriage. The Pope addresses also those Catholics in irregular situations, namely the divorced and civilly remarried. To these persons, the Pope offers a special word of encouragement. The Church has consistently considered second marriages of such individuals adulterous, and thus a cause for the individual's exclusion as long as they persist in adulterous activity from full participation in the Church's sacramental life. Pope Francis says nothing to second-guess this judgment, obedient as it is to the explicit teaching of Jesus. But he laments the fact that for many individuals in non-sacramental marriages, their exclusion from the Church's sacramental life has become a de facto exclusion from the whole of the Church's life. Like Pope John Paul II before him, Pope Francis encourages the divorced and remarried to resume their rightful place in the Christian community, even while a return to the full sacramental communion may as yet remain impossible. With the resumption of an active ecclesial life in view, the Holy Father dedicates chapter 8 of Amoris Laetitia to outlining a way in which pastors can accompany the divorced and remarried on a path of discernment to reintegrate them into the Church's life. The Pope draws both the language and the method of this accompaniment from his Jesuit tradition, which regards discernment as a means of perceiving one's subjective state through an objective and divine lens. Accordingly, the Holy Father encourages priests to help the divorced and remarried to, quote, understand their situation according to the teaching of the Church. This discernment should rely for guidance not only on everything Pope Francis details about marriage in Amoris Laetitia and other magisterial documents, but also in all the relevant passages from the Catechism of the Catholic Church and other magisterial descriptions of the Christian moral life, including Pope John Paul II's Veritate Splendor. For Pope Francis, the goal of a couple's discernment, accompanied by their pastors, is to lead them, quote, where possible, to celebrate the sacrament of matrimony. Until that moment becomes possible, the Pope concludes, pastors are to wait patiently and prayerfully with couples for their restoration to sacramental communion, careful always to avoid both the harm and the scandal of unworthy receptions of the sacraments. Let's look closely at the way in which Pope Francis introduces his appeal for priestly accompaniment of the divorced and remarried in Amoris Laetitia. So hopefully you all have a handout here. We'll be referring to it throughout the talk. Let's read together the first quotation there from paragraph 300 of Amoris. Priests have the duty to accompany the divorced and remarried in helping them to understand their situation according to the teaching of the Church and the guidelines of the bishop. Useful in this process is an examination of conscience through moments of reflection and repentance. A sincere reflection can strengthen trust in the mercy of God, which is not denied anyone. What we are speaking of is a process of accompaniment and discernment, which guides the faithful to an awareness of their situation before God. Conversation with the priest in the internal forum contributes to the formation of a correct judgment on what hinders the possibility of a fuller participation in the life of the Church and on what steps can foster it and make it grow. The Pope here speaks of a process of accompaniment and discernment. For Pope Francis, these are not synonymous terms. They're not two words that point to the same thing. For the Holy Father, accompaniment and discernment are two distinct but interrelated realities. But what does he mean? Perhaps we're all very familiar with the concept of discernment. It's a word we often use. It's a word that has a long history in our own clerical lexicon. We talk about vocational discernment. In the confessional, we help people to discern between good and evil. But what about accompaniment? This is not a common term in the English-speaking pastoral lexicon. We don't speak about the people we're accompanying. We don't even use that word. We speak of the people we direct, yes, the people we counsel, yes, the people we form, yes. But we don't really talk about the people we're accompanying. We don't use that word. And so for some in the English-speaking world, the appearance of the term accompaniment in Amoris Laetitia comes or can come as a surprise. For others, it might be off-putting, a kind of squishy term that indicates a squishy kind of pastoral care. But as we try to figure out its meaning, we should be aware that Pope Francis himself did not coin the term. Whereas the term might be absent in English, the concept of accompaniment has enjoyed both long use and a concrete meaning in other languages. For example, I first heard the term spiritual accompaniment in a French context. As Father Austin said, I did my doctoral studies over in Switzerland at the University of Fribourg. And in the small town of Fribourg, there's the university, but also on the edge of town, a small institute called Philanthropos. And this was founded by a French philosopher to offer French students, college students on their gap year, the opportunity to come to Fribourg and get an intensive introduction into basically basic Catholic catechetical and social teaching. And then with that grounding in Catholic doctrinal and social doctrine tradition, they go off back to university and then pursue their degrees and careers. The Dominicans in Fribourg have a close relationship with Philanthropos, and because of that, the prior came up to me just in my first year in Fribourg and asked if I would be open to providing l'accompagnement spirituel to some of the students. The question frightened me first, because I was just brand new in Fribourg. My French wasn't very good. But even more than that, through this term, I got a sense right away of what he was asking. It wasn't just meeting once or twice with students to give them quick counsel or quick answers about questions that they have. What he was asking for was a real commitment of a year to meet regularly with students, to get to know them, and to walk with them, is their metaphor, through the questions about life and vocation and career that young people, 18, 20, 22-year-olds, 22-year-old are grappling with. Hesitatingly, I said yes, and actually had just one student come to me, mercifully. But it was a wonderful year of speaking and getting, well, first of all, to meet this young woman, to get to know her, and through regular conversations to help her come to deeper understandings of the grace of vocation, but also deeper understanding of just the mystery of life that was unfolding before her. And so for the French at least, l'accompagnement spirituel implies a certain kind of relationship. It's not a master-disciple relationship. It's not a counselor-client relationship, but a kind of friendship in which an exploration of some question is to be undertaken. Again, with the prior envisioned for me, asking me if I would accompany spiritually the students at Philanthropos, was a one-year walking with the students through the questions that they had about life and faith and vocation. The Italian accompagnamento spirituale has much the same meaning. One author, borrowing a phrase from St. Gregory the Great, calls accompagnamento spirituale the art of arts. He explains, spiritual accompaniment deals not with matter and its transformation, but with the human person and his becoming conformed to the image of God. Spiritual accompaniment is the help offered to a person so that he places his whole life under the direction of the Holy Spirit. It is about making people sensitive to listening to the provocations of the promptings of the Spirit. What the French and Italian senses of spiritual accompaniment contribute to a developing English understanding of the term is that accompaniment, at least as used by Pope Francis, involves going beyond giving intermittent spiritual advice or counsel, as we would do in the confessional, and going beyond even the kind of formation or instruction that we would give in marriage prep. Accompaniment involves a personalized walking with someone through a particular difficulty, finally, as the Pope says, to help them to see his or her situation according to the teaching of the church, according to the gospel. Although Pope Francis may be the first pope to single out spiritual accompaniment specifically as a part of the church's pastoral care of the divorced and remarried, again, the concept even is not his creation. A careful reading of more than a century's worth of the papal magisterium on marriage reveals that popes since Leo XIII have urged bishops and priests to give personalized attention to the challenges experienced by married couples, especially those couples in irregular marriages. What I'd like to do this morning is to walk briefly through some of the recent magisterium, to highlight how popes over the last century have collectively contributed to the notion of spiritual accompaniment that Pope Francis brings out explicitly in Amoris Laetitia. As we shall see, certain popes accentuated only certain features of the concept, but over time, a rich pastoral plan emerges from papal teaching that in many ways Amoris Laetitia simply repeats. The purpose of this survey this morning is to help us in the English-speaking world, for whom spiritual accompaniment may still remain a foreign concept, not only to embrace the term, but also to appreciate the humanity, the mercy, and the pastoral sensitivity that for the papal magisterium informs the concept. So let's begin by looking at Pope Leo XIII's encyclical on Christian marriage, Arcanum. The middle of the 19th century was marked by political revolution in Europe and civil war in the United States. These social disruptions in the West were bad for marriage. The revolutions in Europe led some countries there to liberalize their marriage laws, and the war between the states here contributed to a noted and remarkable increase in the divorce rate. Now, although the rate then barely passed 5%, a percentage reflecting that divorce itself was still relatively rare, its increasing presence in Christian society and its increasing tolerance by Western states was enough to cause alarm in religious and political leaders, an alarm clearly reflected in Pope Leo's encyclical. Pope Leo writes Arcanum to address what he calls a deluge of errors regarding the origins, purposes, and nobility of both natural and sacramental marriage. He is concerned that this deluge of errors has inundated national capitals, where government leaders had begun to liberalize the marriage laws of their countries. A key aspect of this liberalization was the legalization of divorce. Leo takes issue with the liberalization itself, to be sure, but he offers also a prophetic witness to the truth of marriage. The Pope warns that domestic and social disorder will be the natural consequence of 1, disregarding the divine origin of marriage, 2, failing to recognize the permanence and indissolubility of marriage, and 3, weakening an institution that domesticates men and protects women. Leo argues that these three errors, combined with the state's refusal to acknowledge the church's authority over marriage, had already led to great confusion among both citizens and believers, weakening both the home and the public square by contributing to the rise of what Leo calls unhallowed marriages. Marriages built with no sense of their permanence, formed outside of grace and in opposition to God's providence. The Holy Father raises the alarm that unhallowed marriages visit a certain evil upon society, like inducing married men and women to infidelity, disrupting the education of children, corrupting morals generally, and finally, devaluing women, who, according to the Holy Father, without the stable protections of marriage, fall prey to the predations of unscrupulous men. Pope Leo implores lawmakers around the world to resist the cries issuing from the radical corners of their societies to authorize divorce. In a direct appeal to politicians, the Pope writes, "Those men show but little wisdom in the idea they have formed of the well-being of the Commonwealth who think that the inherent character of marriage can be perverted with impunity, and who, disregarding the sanctity of religion and of the sacrament, seem to wish to disgrade and dishonor marriage more basely than was done by the heathen laws." Pope Leo concludes his appeal with an ominous prediction. How foolish and senseless it is to expect any public good from divorce, when, on the contrary, it tends to the certain destruction of society. In order to ward off the specter of social destruction, Pope Leo invites national governments to cooperate with the church's pastors in their countries to safeguard marriage. He reminds them that marriage is a holy union authored by God for the preservation and increase of the human race that also belongs to the civic order, and about which the state rightly makes strict inquiry and justly promulgates decrees. Now, once Pope Leo offers a general assessment of the effect of unhallowed marriages on civic and religious society, he turns to address the divorce and remarry. To them, the Pope offers true but sobering words. He continues in his role as a father correcting error and instructing the ignorant. He reminds the divorced and remarried, caught up in perhaps a great confusion of opinions, that no individual or any earthly power can dissolve the bond of Christian marriage whenever this has been ratified and consummated. As a result, the Pope continues, those husbands and wives are guilty of a manifest crime who plan, for whatever reason, to be united in a second marriage before the first one has been ended by death. While those in an impossible marriage may separate, the Pope concludes, neither party is free to enter into a new union. The marital bond endures even the painful realities that might lead to separation. In Arcanum, the Pope, Pope Leo, does not outline a plan of pastoral care for the divorced and remarried. This is not surprising, given the relatively small number of faithful in his day living in that situation. His purpose in the encyclical is more doctrinal and even political in nature. He attempts to check the liberalization of Western marriage laws, which liberalization he fears, if left unchecked, will weaken the health of marriage in Western societies. Still, Pope Leo offers the bishops some word of counsel. And this is the second text that you have on your sheets. Paragraph 44 of Arcanum. Since we well know that none should be excluded from our charity, we commend, venerable brothers, to your fidelity and piety, those unhappy persons who, carried away by the heat of passion and being utterly indifferent to their salvation, live wickedly together without the bond of lawful marriage. Let your utmost care be exercised in bringing such persons back to their duty, and both by your own efforts and by those good men who will consent to help you, strive by every means that they may see how wrongly they have acted, that they may do penance, and that they may be induced to enter into a lawful marriage according to the Catholic rite. Pope Leo reminds the bishops that no one is excluded from charity. Those unhappy persons who live wickedly together without the bond of lawful marriage should receive merciful attention. To these persons, bishops should exercise, again, their utmost care in order to bring such persons back to their duty, which is to celebrate the sacrament of marriage, by which celebration they fulfill God's providence for them as men and women. In 1930, Pope Pius XI promulgated Casti Connubii, his landmark encyclical on Christian marriage. In the introduction to the encyclical, Pius explains that he writes this letter in part to observe the 50th anniversary of our canon. Thus, within the text of the letter, Pope Pius first repeats many of the essential truths articulated by Pope Leo before he develops his own teaching in response to new challenges. And what were these new challenges? If in 1880 the church's pastors had to protest the liberalization of marriage laws by revolutionary governments, then in 1930, the concern of the church's pastors then had moved much closer to home. The political defense of the integrity of marriage already having fallen, the religious defense of marriage was beginning to weaken, not within the Catholic Church herself, but within various Protestant communions. For example, just 4 months before the release of Casti Connubii, the bishops of the Anglican Communion gathered for the 1930 Lambeth Conference, at which they adopted a permissive stance toward both divorce and artificial contraception. Casti Connubii constitutes the Catholic Church's response to this demoralizing development within the Christian world. Thus, the language and the tone of the encyclical is very similar to our canon. In it, Pope Pius adopts the paternal task, mercifully yet firmly, of teaching truth and correcting error. Pius describes his aim to the world's bishops in the encyclical's opening paragraphs. He says, "Not only do we, looking with paternal eye on the universal world from this apostolic see as from a watchtower, but you also, venerable brethren, see, and seeing deeply, grieve with us that a great number of men, forgetful of that divine work of redemption, either entirely ignore or shamelessly deny the great sanctity of Christian wedlock, or relying on the false principles of a new and utterly perverse morality, too often trample it underfoot. And since these most pernicious errors and depraved morals have begun to spread even among the faithful, and are gradually gaining ground, in our office as Christ's vicar upon earth and supreme shepherd and teacher, we consider it our duty to raise our voice to keep the flock committed to our care from poisoned pastures, and as far as in us lies, to preserve the flock from harm." Immediately upon announcing the aim of his encyclical, Pius launches into a robust defense of the divine authorship of marriage, the importance of consent for contracting marriage, the indissolubility of the bond, and the right of every man and woman to marry. He also reminds the bishops of the responsibility of states to acknowledge and promote each of these four truths concerning marriage. Over the course of the entire encyclical, Pope Pius organizes his discussion around St. Augustine's doctrine of the threefold blessing of marriage. Those three blessings being children, the mutual fidelity of the spouses, and the sacrament itself. Given the centrality that Pius gives to Augustine's doctrine, it is in light of these three blessings that the Pope treats the issue of divorce, explaining how the voluntary abandonment of the marital covenant by either or both spouses offends these blessings. All at once, divorce undermines the well-being of children. It offends the chaste fidelity that defines a man as a husband and a woman as a wife. And it turns the couple against the grace of God, by which the couple ought to reflect to the world Christ's love for the church. Pope Pius is not content, however, simply to denounce divorce. He wants to understand the modern desire for it, And so he considers the various reasons given by those who advocate for legalized divorce. Pius's rhetoric may seem out of place today. He calls the logic of divorce neo-pagan. But we should appreciate how he engages the arguments of divorce in order to give them an authoritative Christian response. He considers four commonly made arguments that promote divorce as a social good. First, some divorce advocates claim that it is good for either party in a marriage that one who is innocent should have the right to separate from the guilty, or that the guilty should be withdrawn from a union which is unpleasing to him and against his will. Second, the argument is made that children can be the beneficiaries of divorce. If it were only through divorce that a child would be saved from the shortcomings of bad parents and thereby obtain a proper education. Third, divorce advocates argue that not only can the man, a woman, or child benefit from divorce, but also can society as a whole, as divorce dissolves those unions that are burdensome to society and bear to it no tangible fruit. Fourth and finally, some argue that the marriage contract is not unique among contracts, and therefore it should, when necessary or desired, be dissolved just as easily as other contracts. To each of these four arguments, Pope Pius responds with the same simple teaching of the Lord Jesus. What God has joined together, let no man put asunder. He continues, if any man, acting contrary to this law, shall have put asunder, his action is null and void, and the consequence remains, as Christ himself has explicitly confirmed. Everyone that puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he that marries her that is put away from her husband commits adultery. Moreover, these words refer to every kind of marriage, Pope Pius reminds his readers. Even that which is natural, only. The Pope concludes that when faced with a grave difficulty, a husband and wife may separate, but they cannot divorce. If it is certain, Pius writes, that the bond of marriage cannot be loosed even on account of the sin of adultery, it is evident that the other weaker excuses that can be and are usually brought forward or of no value whatsoever. Pope Pius ends his discussion of divorce by observing that while advocates often promote the supposed benefits of divorce, they often overlook its obvious evils. Pius lists five of them. First, he says that when divorce becomes an option for couples, the marriage contract itself becomes insecure, or at least gives ground for anxiety. Second, the specter of divorce hovering over a marriage weakens the goodwill and cooperation of a husband and wife in daily life. Third, divorce can prove for either the husband or the wife a harmful inducement to infidelity. Fourth, divorce proves to be a great obstacle to the proper rearing of children. And worse, it places children at the center of the quarrels and jealousies of divorced spouses. And finally, Pius observes that divorce places an unequal burden on women. Divorce lowers their dignity and position in civil society, as the divorced woman risks, quote, being considered an outcast and a slave to the lusts of men. Against these evils, Pope Pius points to the priest as the bulwark of marital holiness. It is in the priest that married couples find both pastoral support and spiritual encouragement to remain faithful to their vows. Through the ministrations of priests, married couples receive the grace necessary to avoid temptation, to practice the faith, and to surrender to God, especially as God's providence traces out for them the contours of married life. Let's look at paragraph 100 of Casti Canubi. Quite fittingly, therefore, Pope Pius writes, and quite in accordance with the divine norm of Christian sentiment, do those pastors of souls act who, to prevent married people from failing in the observance of God's law, urge them to perform their duty and exercise their religion so that they should give themselves to God, continually ask for his divine assistance, frequent the sacraments, and always nourish and preserve a loyal and thoroughly sincere devotion to God. Though he doesn't explicitly say it here, Pope Pius points to the priest as a source of mercy for married couples. As one who accompanies them as they prepare for marriage, to be sure, and also after the wedding, as the couple strives to grow daily in marital fidelity. Like Pope Leo in Arcanum, Pope Pius in Casticanubi exercises the mercy of a teacher, highlighting error and promoting virtue. We do not yet see articulated a specific pastoral plan for the divorced and remarried. As with Leo, it seems sufficient to Pius as the chief shepherd of the flock to sound the alarm over the religious and social dangers of divorce. The next time that the Church gave substantive attention to marriage and divorce was at the Second Vatican Council. In the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, the issue of divorce is taken up with a new tone. This is not surprising given the historical context within which the Council sessions unfolded. When Pope Pius promulgated Casticanubii in 1930, the social context was much the same as Pope Leo's in 1880. Around 1880, the divorce rate in the United States, for example, hovered around 5%. By 1930, the rate rose somewhat and hovered around 16%. That's a threefold increase. But the incidence of divorce still remained relatively low. Fewer than one in five marriages ended in divorce. By 1965, things had changed. The U.S. divorce rate in the mid-1960s was 25%. One in four marriages were ending in divorce. And that was dramatically down from the period just after the Second World War, when the divorce rate rose above 40%. Though the rate was half of what it is today, it showed the promise of increasing. The divorce rate increasing, not only in the U.S., but in other Western nations as well, as social change began to ferment. Though the United Nations 1949 Declaration of Human Rights did not list divorce as a fundamental human right, it did not exclude it either, precisely because it left the quality of indissolubility out of its definition of marriage. Consequently, litigants around the world in the 1960s and 70s began to appeal to the Declaration when suing their countries for loosening the divorce laws, finding within the Declaration's articulation of the right to marry an implicit articulation of the right to divorce. For the Council Fathers, therefore, divorce was not simply a social threat, as it had been for Pope Leo and for Pope Pius. It was now a reality, a harmful reality, and the Council Fathers treated it as such. Thus, they refer to divorce as a plague that profanes marriage. But the Council Fathers did not then decry the evils of divorce, nor did they pronounce on the status of the divorce, and much less on the status of the divorced and remarried. Instead, the Council Fathers made only three brief statements germane to our discussion. The first recalls the indissoluble character of marriage. The Council Fathers wrote, "Marriage, to be sure, is not instituted solely for procreation. Rather, its very nature as an unbreakable compact between persons and the welfare of the children both demand that the mutual love of the spouses be embodied in a rightly ordered manner, that it grow and ripen. Therefore, marriage persists as a whole manner and communion of life and maintains its value and indissolubility, even when, despite the often intense desire of the couple, offspring are lacking." The second statement reminds political leaders of their duty to preserve and promote the permanence of marriage. Public authority, the Council Fathers write, should regard it as a sacred duty to recognize, protect, and promote their authentic nature, to shield public morality, to favor the prosperity of home life. The right of parents to beget and educate their children in the bosom of the family must be safeguarded. And finally, the third statement of the Council Fathers reminds clergy of the mercy that they are to show everyone as possessors of the threefold office of Christ, to preach, to sanctify, and to govern. On your sheets, there's paragraph 52 from Gaudium et Spes. It devolves on priests, duly trained about family matters, to nurture the vocations of spouses by a variety of pastoral means, by preaching God's word, by liturgical worship, and by other spiritual aids to conjugal and family life, to sustain them sympathetically and patiently in difficulties, and to make them courageous through love, so that families which are truly illustrious can be formed. Given the increasing prevalence of divorce at the time, the Council Fathers understandably remained subdued in their descriptions of divorce's evils. But they accentuated, in the clearest magisterial statement to date, the note of mercy that should inform a priest's care for the divorced. The priest is to, quote, sustain them sympathetically and engage their difficulties patiently. What we might call the pastoral turn of Gaudium et Spes takes full shape in Familiaris Consortio, Pope John Paul II's apostolic exhortation following the 1980 Synod on the Christian Family. In Familiaris Consortio, the conciliar turn acquires two essential expressions. First, denunciation of the evil of divorce, so prevalent as we have seen in the writings of Popes Leo and Pius, is replaced with praise for the good of marriage and family life. Accordingly, John Paul does not detail the destructiveness of divorce. This does not mean, however, that he avoids the topic. To be sure, all of divorce's destructiveness remains in full view in Familiaris Consortio, and not just not in plain sight. It remains. This view of the destructiveness of divorce remains as the implied consequence of what is lost by those who fail to attain the high goods of marriage. In other words, John Paul does not lay bare the devastation of a shattered marriage. In other words, he doesn't need to. Too many had already learned what that devastation is by their own experience. Instead, Pope John Paul speaks only of the excellence of marriage, and in so doing only implies the harm that divorce introduces into family life. John Paul announces this plan, his plan for reflecting on the mystery of marriage at the very beginning of Familiaris Consortio. He writes, "At a moment of history in which the family is the object of numerous forces that seek to destroy it or in some way deform it, and aware that the well-being of society and her own good are intimately tied to the good of the family, the Church perceives in a more urgent and compelling way her mission of proclaiming to all people the plan of God for marriage and the family, ensuring their full vitality and human and Christian development, and thus contributing to the renewal of society and to the people of God." With divorce rates in Western nations hovering around 50%, Pope John Paul II acknowledges that a new conversation on marriage is required. The people of God do not need to hear new descriptions of the old evil that they are suffering. They need to be reminded instead of the old truths about goods that are ever new. This is the first expression of the conciliar turn found in Familiaris Consortio. The second appears in the explicit plan that John Paul outlines for the pastoral care of the divorced and remarried. Throughout Familiaris Consortio, Pope John Paul II reminds priests of their roles as teachers, not only as communicators of truth, but also as guides to living virtuously and freely. The guidance that a priest provides includes not only teaching dogma, but also instilling in believers a true sense of the faith, according to which, since they themselves can discern the truths of nature and of grace, and through the exercise then of their own prudence, make good moral decisions in accord with that truth. The first text you have on your handout from Familiaris Consortio, from paragraph 5. Because it is the task of the apostolic ministry to ensure that the church remains in the truth of Christ and to lead her ever more deeply into that truth, the pastors must promote the sense of the faith in all the faithful, examine and authoritatively judge the genuineness of its expressions, and educate the faithful in an ever more mature evangelical discernment. Formation in discernment is one of the pillars of Pope John Paul II's pastoral plan for the divorced and remarried. A second, we might say, is accompaniment. As mother, the Pope writes elsewhere in the encyclical, the church is close to the many married couples who find themselves in difficulty. In another place, he writes, the pastoral intervention of the church in support of the family is a matter of urgency. Therefore, he continues, the church's pastoral action must be progressive in the sense that it must follow the family, accompanying it step by step in the different stages of its formation and development. For John Paul II, this means concretely that, quote, priests must unceasingly act towards families as fathers, brothers, pastors, and teachers, assisting them with the means of grace and enlightening them with the light of truth. Again, he continues, the teaching of priests must always be in full harmony with the authentic magisterium of the church, in such a way as to help the people of God to gain a correct sense of the faith, to be subsequently applied to practical life. In light of the pastoral needs of the divorced and remarried, Pope John Paul II insists the church engage the divorced and remarried mercifully with gestures of discernment and accompaniment. And we look at that second text you have in your sheet from paragraph 84. The church, which was set up to lead to salvation all people, and especially the baptized, cannot abandon to their own devices those who have been previously bound by sacramental marriage and who have attempted a second marriage. The church will therefore make untiring efforts to put at their disposal the church's means of salvation. For Pope John Paul II, this means, first of all, that priests should discern carefully the situation of each couple. He acknowledges that no two situations are exactly alike. Some individuals have entered into a second union after being unjustly abandoned by their first spouse, the one to whom they remain sacramentally married. Others have entered into a second union after themselves destroying their first marriage. Still others have entered into a second union for the sake of their children. Among these, some may be subjectively convinced of the invalidity of their first marriages. But the Pope explains that each of these situations requires proper discernment by pastors, so that their accompaniment of the persons involved, of the divorced and remarried, might correspond to the specifics of their situation. Whatever the circumstances of their second marriage, the divorced and remarried must be accompanied, the Holy Father says, with love and mercy. And they should never consider themselves separated from the church. Pope John Paul insists that as baptized persons, the divorced and remarried must share in the church's life. Priests, therefore, must encourage them, quote, to listen to the word of God, to attend the sacrifice of the Mass, to persevere in prayer, to contribute to works of charity and to community efforts in favor of justice, to bring up their children in the Christian faith, to cultivate the spirit and practice of penance, and thus implore day by day God's grace. In turn, the Pope writes, let the church pray for them, encourage them and show herself a merciful mother and thus sustain them in faith and hope. In order to specify his pastoral plan for the divorced and remarried, Pope John Paul II makes two more points. First, he reminds pastors that their accompaniment of the divorced and remarried involves not admitting them to Eucharistic communion. This is due to the fact that their marital situation, quote, objectively contradicts God's plan for marriage, that every indissoluble union be a sign of the union of the love between Christ and his church. The second point is that the sacrament of reconciliation remains closed to the divorced and remarried. Unless repenting of having broken their first covenant, they, quote, undertake a way of life that is no longer in contradiction with the indissolubility of marriage. This means concretely that those in situations where a man and a woman in a second non-sacramental union cannot satisfy the obligation to separate, they can, quote, abstain from the acts proper to married couples. While the mercy of the first of these two points is sometimes doubted, though it should not be, it is the mercy of the second point that Pope John Paul II makes here that's often overlooked. Consider that point carefully, especially in light of everything that the Church has consistently taught about divorce and which we reviewed this morning. It is by way of a merciful exception that John Paul allows the faithful in a second marriage who remain sacramentally united to other persons to whom they owe and from whom are owed marital rights might for some grave reason eschew the obligation to separate and instead remain together as long as they refrain not from all acts proper to married couples like the sharing of the whole of life together, but from those acts most proper to married couples, namely those acts of intimacy that express and ratify the marital bond. Pope John Paul allows that those who are not sacramentally married may live as if they were, despite the bonds to their first spouses, as long as they do not give to their second spouses what absolutely and exclusively belongs to the first. To my mind, this is the great mercy offered in familiaris consortio. And the Holy Father calls pastors to accompany couples to understand and adopt this witness to the truth of marriage. I conclude with one final illustration of the Church's long-held merciful regard for the divorced and remarried. It appears in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith's 1994 letter to bishops concerning the reception of communion by the divorced and remarried. Coming 13 years after familiaris consortio, the letter reiterates the teaching of John Paul's exhortation that the divorced and remarried are excluded objectively from Eucharistic communion, regardless of the subjective factors that might figure into their particular situation. Simply stated, quote, members of the faithful who live together as husband and wife with persons other than their legitimate spouses may not receive Holy Communion. Nevertheless, Cardinal Ratzinger insists that the divorced and remarried are to receive specialized care. He writes that, quote, actually, why don't we read this whole text here? It's from paragraph 2. The difficulties and sufferings of those faithful in irregular marriage situations merit special attention. Pastors are called to help them experience the charity of Christ and the maternal closeness of the Church, receiving them with love, exhorting them to trust in God's mercy, and suggesting, with prudence and respect, concrete ways of conversion and sharing in the life of the community of the Church. Cardinal Ratzinger laments that in the years since Familiaris Consortio's promulgation, the pastoral plan for the divorced and remarried outlined there had yet to be fully realized. More was required, quote, to do everything that can be done to strengthen in the love of Christ and the Church those faithful in irregular marriage situations. to convince the divorced and remarried that they are not being discriminated against unjustly. Priests and the lay faithful alike must, quote, suffer and love in solidarity with the persons concerned, so that they may recognize in their burden the sweet yoke and the light burden of Christ. The whole of paragraph 10 of the letter is beautiful, and I thought it'd be helpful to read that in whole as a kind of conclusion to our discussion this morning. In keeping with what has been said, the desire expressed by the Synod of Bishops, adopted by the Holy Father John Paul II as his own and put into practice with dedication and with praiseworthy initiatives by bishops, priests, religious, and lay faithful, is yet to be fully realized. Namely, with solicitous charity to do everything that can be done to strengthen in the love of Christ and the Church those faithful in irregular marriage situations. Only thus will it be possible for them to receive the message of Christian marriage and endure in faith the distress of their situation. In pastoral action, one must do everything possible to ensure that this is understood not to be a matter of discrimination, but only of absolute fidelity to the will of Christ, who has restored and entrusted to us anew the indissolubility of marriage as a gift of the Creator. It will be necessary for pastors and the community of the faithful to suffer and to love in solidarity with the persons concerned, so that they may recognize in their burden the sweet yoke and the light burden of Jesus. Their burden is not sweet and light in the sense of being small or insignificant, but becomes light because the Lord, and with him the whole church, shares it. It is the task of pastoral action, which has to be carried out with total dedication, to offer this help, founded in truth and in love, together. To suffer in love with the divorced and remarried. This was the merciful plan of the Church articulated before Amoris Laetitia, and it remains the Church's merciful plan afterwards. This is the plan of accompaniment, as the expression of a personalized, patient, and suffering love. The priest joins himself, even affectively, to the divorced and remarried in his care for them, in order to help them to discern their situation, to come to a true awareness of their situation in the light of God's law. Popes Leo XIII and Pius XI demonstrated the teaching aspect of this accompaniment. The Second Vatican Council urged pastors to develop a teaching that goes beyond mere declaration to a real engagement with those to whom the teaching applies. Pope John Paul II, with the help of Cardinal Ratzinger, developed a pastoral plan that exhorts priests to personally bear the burdens of the divorced and remarried. And finally, Pope Francis systematizes everything that has come before him on this topic into a program of accompaniment and discernment. In this brief survey of magisterial teaching that we've unfolded this morning, we not only can appreciate how accompaniment has found a place in the papal magisterium, but we can also see how the magisterium itself has accompanied pastors in the development of their pastoral care for the divorced and remarried. We, the accompanying, are also the accompanied, as through persistent exhortation, the Church has patiently and lovingly encouraged us in our work. Let us heed these persistent exhortations and place the accompaniment of the flock at the very heart of our pastoral ministry. Thank you.